if you're innovating, creating, or making a difference.
This show is for you. Welcome to Over Coffee. I'm Dot Cannon. Here on Over Coffee, we talk with artists and innovators about the process of changing the world in terms of what they do.
I tell stories about my kids. I tell stories about navigating the men's locker room as a trans person. You know, really put a face on the issue. We're not the monstrous predators that the opposition has portrayed us as, but we're just folks just trying to do daily things like other folks.
Willie Wilkinson is all about creating environments that support everyone. Willie is an award-winning transgender writer and advocate whose groundbreaking work has included starting the nation's first program to provide equal health care access to transgender patients. As a public health consultant, he's trained hundreds of organizations on the ways to provide equal access and affirming environments to members of the LGBTQ community. He's also the author of the memoir, Born on the Edge of Race and Gender, A Voice for Cultural Competency, in which he gives an honest examination of the discrimination he himself has faced as a transgender man of mixed heritage. His book won a 2016 Lambda Literary Award in the transgender nonfiction category, and he's going to be doing a live reading in Pasadena on Saturday, October 15th at San Gabriel Valley Pride's 15th Pride Festival. Willie, what do you remember very best about your growing up years that helped you to find your own voice?
Well, I grew up in San Mateo, and as a trans child growing up in the early 70s, I was unique in that I didn't know any other trans kids, and I guess I knew that I was pretty much on my own and I needed to be confident in who I was. As a trans person and as a mixed heritage person, I felt very different. So I suppose it was a process over decades. I don't know that I had a strong voice as a child in terms of articulating who I was or articulating the issues that I've come to articulate as an adult, but I guess it was just being okay with being myself as an individual that helped me come into my voice later into adulthood.
As a child, especially as one whom your parents saw as a girl, how did you find that strength? Most 9-year-old kids don't have that kind of strength to say, I am me and that's it.
Oh, well, yes, I did change my name to Willie at age 9 in the early 70s, and it was just always very clear to me that I'm not, and I was meant to be a boy, which was hard for people to understand that. But, you know, I just really resisted the girl name that I was given, and so I just needed to say this is, you know, I thought about it for a long time about what name I was going to pick for myself, and then once I decided, I just announced it. This is it, my name. And some people were able to get with that, and some people took a long time to come up to speed on that. And it was not at a time where we were talking about the rights of trans children. No one was talking about transgender issues at all in any way that was positive, or there was not much of a conversation at all anyway. So it wasn't, you know, there was no social context. There was no cultural resonance for me to assert that identity, but I just did. Because that's who I was.
Please tell me about your journey from there.
Well, when I turned 18, it was not really an option to come out as transgender because there was no community or visible movement. And so I came out as a lesbian, and which was challenging in that, you know, you had to be female to be a lesbian, and I never really had seen myself as female. But so first I came out as a woman because I was learning about feminism and really, you know, being excited about women walking in the streets at night with Take Back the Night marches, you know, the whole healthcare access issue that had been so male-dominated. So I came into feminism and coming out as a woman, and then I came out as a lesbian. And then I came out as a woman of color and as a lesbian of color, as an Asian American. And so that was an exciting time during the 80s. And then when the movement, the transgender movement, took off in the mid-90s in San Francisco, then I came out as transgender. And that was an exciting time, too, because there had not really been a cohesive community, and, you know, we had not come together to fight for our rights until that time. And that's when we got discrimination protections in San Francisco, the city and county of San Francisco, based on gender identity. And so that was an exciting time, and I came out as transgender. But at that time, because I had such connections with the women's movement, the lesbian movement, I really did not feel ready to transition to male. And I really felt that I was a third-gendered person, that my gender was inextricably linked to my mixed heritage, that I was a combination of male and female, both male and female, or beyond male and female in some way. And so I circled around medically transitioning for a number of years, and then was actively deciding not to, and to live in a more complex gender place, gender identity. And then I did ultimately, after becoming a parent, I did ultimately decide to medically transition about 5 years ago, and I'm happy I did. And part of that was, I mean, it was decades of contemplation, but part of it was that I needed to be seen as the father that I felt that I always was. And so now I have three kids who are ages 4, 7, and 10. And so I'm dad.
You have the neatest short chapter in your book about your son and what he says to you and what you say to him. I wish you'd tell me a little bit about this.
Yes. Well, that I love to read that piece. It's entertaining for folks. People enjoy that piece a lot. And this was at a time prior to my medical transition, and I was out with my son, who was 4, my oldest, who was 4 at the time, and we'd adventured in the woods, and we came back, and he asked me, "Dada, are you a man?" And I thought, oh, okay, well, this is a great opportunity to talk about this, my gender, because, you know, I was always dada to him. I was never mom. I never identified as mom. And, you know, I explained to him that I, you know, was born female, but I've always seen myself as a guy, and that I was transgender. And he, you know, the wheels were turning, and he was thinking about it. And then he thought, oh, you're a transformer. And he was so excited by that connection. It was like, yes, of course, that is what makes perfect sense. You know, this is a little guy who could just, you know, he was so amazing in his ability to build with Legos and work a transformer in minutes. And so it just made perfect sense. So that was a moment, and I think it's powerful because it's a very positive image, and it's kind of a superpower. And I thought, oh, wow, you know, like, after a lifetime of being shamed, what a great way to reframe this experience.
I love that. You taught me a lot as I was reading your book, because there were so many things I didn't know, including the suicide statistics you quote about the transgender community and a lot of the discrimination you face. Would you tell me about these?
Yes, yes. Well, there's no other demographic with a high a suicide rate as transgender individuals. And from one very large-scale study done a few years ago, 6,456 participants in every state and territory of the U.S., 41% said they had attempted suicide. And other studies have corroborated that data. And, you know, really, and that's suicide attempts. That's actual attempts as opposed to ideation, thinking about it, and that number actually goes up when you factor in other issues. People have experienced violence or lost a job because of discrimination, those types of issues. And so I write about suicide within the framework of a friend who died by suicide, and to talk about that experience and how it impacts the community. It's so much. I mean, in the transgender community, you know, when we hear about someone passing away and there's no cause of death immediately stated, I think we all just kind of go, oh, no, you know, we lost another one. And it's so rampant, and it's very heartbreaking to see that number, those numbers going up now, not going down, even though we have the Internet, we have resources, education, awareness, so many support services that are available to people, and yet we're losing so many young people to suicide because it's so challenging to be transgender. There's so much discrimination in every sphere of society, people losing their families and their communities, their jobs because of their transgender status. And so it's something certainly that drives my work to educate folks about transgender issues and to help. I do conduct a high volume of transgender cultural competency training with community health providers, substance use disorder, prevention and treatment, mental health, medical providers and other public health providers, educational institutions and businesses, and, you know, to talk about how we can create trans-affirming services, trans-affirming campuses and schools, trans-affirming workplaces, just because, you know, this is an important issue to be aware of, and, you know, we want everybody to feel supported. So, it's a huge concern.
You give a wonderful resource in your book, Suicide Prevention for Trans Youth.
Oh, yes. Well, what's exciting is that very recently there's a new suicide prevention resource called the Trans Lifeline, and that is trans people supporting other trans people. So Trans Lifeline is at 877-565-8860 in the United States. You can also check it out online at translifeline.org. And there's also a number in Canada, 877-330-6366. So I think that's exciting. You know, of course, they also welcome donations. It's just an organization that has just started in the last year or so. It's a new organization, and it's exciting that it's trans people who are developing skills as peers to provide support to other trans people who are experiencing mental health crises. And there's also the Trevor Project, which is a longstanding support hotline for LGBTQ young people. So you can check that one out at thetrevorproject.org, 866-488-7386.
We've got thetrevorproject.org, translifeline.org. These are going to save some lives, hopefully.
Yes, and it's so great that we have those resources.
We talked about the various environments in which Willie works as a trainer in cultural competency.
You know, I am a public health consultant, and I do conduct a high volume of training and technical assistance with community health organizations. And, you know, really, I'm working to increase folks' cultural competency so they understand the population better, so that the interactions are appropriate and respectful, but also so that people can enhance their systems, so that they have trans-affirming systems, you know, such as asking the appropriate questions in the intake process, understanding, you know, how people identify in terms of their gender, things like, you know, how they identify their gender and, you know, appropriate pronoun, those pieces. And, you know, everything from providing equal access in gender-specific environments, whether it's restroom access, bed placement in hospital settings, you know, support groups for gender-specific groups, to, you know, really evaluating their mission and values, if that's something that would be helpful to update, you know, particularly in gender-specific organizations, people looking at, well, what does that mean for us in terms of the work we're doing with transgender individuals? You know, providing training for their staff as well as educating their client population in settings where there may be, you know, for instance, treatment facilities or treatment programs where maybe the staff are on board about understanding trans experience, but the clients are making pejorative comments, you know, looking at how can they create an environment where everybody is uplifted and everyone can participate comfortably. So there's many different pieces that come up, and many organizations seek me out for training and technical assistance because they realize they're seeing trans clients, they don't feel prepared, they're not sure what to do, they have questions, and I work with folks at all knowledge levels, and that's why I love this work. You know, whether folks are at square one of understanding this or they've been thinking about it for a while, there's so many questions that come up and challenges that come up in service provision, and so we look at, you know, how can they enhance their systems on an organizational level.
Let's say I have a social agency, my staff knows to welcome transgender folks who are receiving services, but a client makes a really inappropriate response. What do you do?
Well, I mean, as in any situation, you know, if a client says something that's really racist or really sexist, I mean, clearly that's going to be against the agreements that the clients have. But a lot of times people think, oh, but, you know, I'm not going to say something racist, but I can say something homophobic or transphobic, you know, and realizing, oh, no, that's also considered hate speech. That's not appropriate. And so it's really setting up an expectation from the get that, you know, as a client of our program, these are the expectations, you know, and for staff members to be able to nip it in the bud you know, model leadership around, you know, recognizing when something like that occurs and addressing it. And providing opportunity to educate in a way that's non-punishing, hopefully. You know, so it's an opportunity to learn from the experience as well. But, you know, I think it's about setting up the system so that people are, you know, signing on to certain agreements when they become enrolled in the program, that this is the expectation in terms of, you know, we're all here for the same reasons to, you know, be part of a healing process, and we want to uplift everyone.
You have three great toolkits at the end of your book, and I'd love for you to give me one tip from each of these, because you talk about becoming more transgender affirming in the workplace, where we offer services, and in schools. How can a workplace become more transgender affirming?
Well, I think, you know, one of the key things in a workplace is that sometimes an individual will transition on the job, and that can be very scary for a transgender person, particularly depending on where they live and if there are discrimination protections, because people do often, if they're not in a state that has protections, legal protections, they may lose their job because they're transitioning or because they come out as transgender. So I think, you know, for workplaces to say, yes, we support you, you're a valued employee, and how can we support you in your process? You know, that's such a huge piece right there. Having a point person be the person that is communicating this information to other staff members and taking on a leadership role can be really helpful rather than requiring the transgender person to do all the communication. You know, setting a time when that communication will happen, whatever it is. This is a name, a change in name and pronoun, you know, those kinds of things. And, you know, what's called a transition plan. It can be very, very helpful. You know, sometimes it's just that somebody is saying, well, I'm not medically transitioning. I want you all to know that I want you to refer to me by a different pronoun. So helping people understand that, how somebody identifies their gender and being supportive of that, whatever that is, can be very, very powerful in creating a trans-affirming workplace.
If somebody just isn't certain, somebody says so-and-so is transgender, is there a polite way to ask about pronouns and appropriate way to which to refer to that individual?
Oh, yeah, good question. You know, I do encourage people, there's not a perfect handbook on this, but I do encourage people to ask politely and privately if possible for clarification, just so you know what's appropriate in terms of how to refer to an individual in terms of the pronoun or gendered terms that might be used. And I think it's much better than avoiding it, the pronouns, you know, like repeating their name over and over again. I think it's better to ascertain what's appropriate and to do your best to refer to them appropriately. And if you feel like you made a mistake, recover gracefully, apologize, move on. You know, I think it's important to let folks know you're coming from the heart and that you see them and support them and honor their identity, you know, rather than, you know, making a mistake because you're resistant to recognizing their identity.
You will want them to know that you mean well, and that's just, wow, I'm really sorry, that was clumsy of me, that kind of thing.
Right, right. And mistakes happen. But I think, you know, it's important to understand, you know, what is appropriate for an individual? You know, how do they want to be referred? You know, a lot of times I think people in situations, they, you know, when they're encountering folks, they may think, oh, they're being polite by referring to somebody as ma'am or sir. And, you know, sometimes that's not going to be appropriate, and that isn't going to be polite for that individual. So it's helpful to understand, you know, what is appropriate for an individual.
Let's also look at schools and what something schools can do to make their transgender students feel welcome.
Yes. Well, and, you know, it's exciting that there are many young people that are coming out in K-12 settings. And, you know, we're fortunate in California in that we have protections for trans students in publicly funded schools, so that including K-12 and colleges and universities. And I think, you know, regardless of what type of school, it's so important to honor that identity for that trans student. You know, one of the great challenges has been restroom access, people being able to use the restroom in accordance with their gender identity and expression. And so, you know, a lot of times students are holding it all day long, or they're using the staff bathroom that's often locked, and they have to wait for someone to open it and makes them late for class. And so those kinds of things, are even not being able to take physical education because of their gender identity, and they need that to graduate. So, you know, I think ensuring that trans students are honored for who they say they are in terms of their gender identity. You know, there's been this mythology, you know, perpetuated by the opposition that, oh, a trans, you know, someone who's going to just say they're trans to go and hurt somebody in the bathroom. That has not been the case. People are not pretending to be transgender, and there have been no incidents of someone, you know, going into the bathroom for the wrong reasons. You know, people are just trying to pee in peace like everybody else. And so I think, you know, just treating folks, you know, and providing equal access and recognizing people's gender, their name if they change their name, and, you know, providing an educational opportunity for them like everyone else.
Willie is also piloting another innovation, the first school program in the nation for kids with transgender parents. However, this one is going to take some time developing, he says.
We started the program and we found that it was hard to get people together because people were spread out. What's interesting about this is that there's a movement of trans people choosing parenthood, and it's so young. You know, most of the people's kids are 5 and under. So I think we have to wait a little bit longer to really be able to pilot this in the schools. And we do have some kids in the Bay Area that have, you know, families that have been interested in connecting. And yet we found that we needed to look at doing more education in the schools and doing some other work before we really move forward with this program. But, you know, whereas in the 80s, lesbians started to really choose parenthood as lesbian-identified folks, and that movement has really taken off where there are many LGBT-headed households, particularly lesbian-headed households or queer women-identified folks. And yet, for trans folks, you know, most of us have kids. Those of us who have chosen parenthood as trans-identified individuals, rather than coming out, you know, having kids and then coming out later as trans. Those of us who have chosen parenthood as trans folks, many of us have very young kids. So we'll see how that goes over time, and we have more and more numbers, and then we can really look at supporting young people in the schools.
That'll be exciting to see the kids grow into that, as your son is, just knowing that that's a reality, that dad is transgender. And
yes.
This is really cool.
Yeah, and my kids have, you know, they love having that kind of opportunity to talk about them. I mean, they have transgender stuffed animals, and they love to talk about their stuffed animals experience and so forth.
I love that. What's been one of your own best experiences, let's say within the last 6 months or so, as an educator doing the work you do?
Oh, well, just yesterday I worked with some wonderful folks who are starting a trans clinic, and in a county that has not had these services. It's been years in the making. And so it's just wonderful to see that, you know, there were a group of people who have been fighting to start this clinic, and yet the actual staff members, some of them are new to the issue. And so, but to see the enthusiasm that people have who may not understand all the terminology or the different ways that people identify, you know, but who are eager to learn, and they're just, you know, they were just asking a lot of questions about, you know, how they could support trans people, how they could, you know, refer to people appropriately, as well as, you know, developing their cultural competency, as well as developing their medical competency, because we're really seeing a changing landscape in the healthcare access for trans folks in California, in that for the first time, after years and years of advocacy, trans people are being able to get their healthcare needs covered by health insurance. And so, you know, people are actually getting surgery paid for by insurance, which is a huge victory, which not every state has. And so, you know, we're, you know, seeing, well, how can folks understand the post-surgical complications that might be happening for folks, or some of the health issues that are happening? So that's been really exciting, you know, working with them. And that was just yesterday. I mean, I worked with so many different kinds of entities, you know, and so, I mean, it's very exciting to me just to work with groups that are eager to learn about this, that are supportive, you know, down with the issue, great allies, and, you know, that's very uplifting for me to see so many folks who are really dedicated to increasing their cultural competency and, you know, providing an equal access to the best of their abilities. So, yeah, I've been working with people who work with families with young children, whether in services or in educational settings like preschools, K through 12, you know, colleges. I mean, there's so many different entities. And, you know, I love also working with the mental health providers, substance use disorder treatment. So there's been, I've been working with so many different folks, and I love that they're coming from the heart and they want to do the right thing.
What can one person do?
What can one person do?
Yes. Knowing full well that you're one person and you're doing all this.
Well, you know, I think it's important to educate yourself about the issue. It's important to talk to others about the issue, support people. I think, you know, if people are able to donate to organizations that are working towards equality for transgender folks and, you know, other support services that are supporting folks. I mean, there are great programs that are supporting trans people, you know, just to provide support groups. But also there's so many pieces to it. I mean, for instance, the issue of employment is a huge issue in the transgender community. You know, I mean, we see these images of these rich celebrities. You know, that is not really the story for so many trans people. You know, in one study, you know, it showed that people who were discriminated against in childhood were, I forget now, I think it was something like 7 times more likely to make $10,000 a year. So it was, you know, really it's like we're looking at unemployment and underemployment. So programs that are supporting trans people develop job skills, get connected to employers that are eager to employ trans folks, you know, those pieces are really, really important. In San Francisco, there's the Transgender Economic Empowerment Initiative, now known as Transgender Employment Program, through the San Francisco LGBT Center. And they've done great work as the first program in the nation to support folks on trans employment issues. So that's a great organization that I've been working with off and on over the years. And there's other programs in other cities that have popped up to support trans people in employment. So, you know, there's just so many ways that people can get involved in terms of educating about the issue and advocating for these issues in whatever setting, whether it's in the workplace, whether it's on their campus, or helping to support these organizations.
I didn't know about the Economic Power Initiative till just now.
Yes.
When did they start, and what are some of the things they're doing?
Well, let's see, it's been since the, I don't know, almost 10 years possibly since they started. And it's been great work in terms of helping folks develop resumes and interviewing skills, as well as even just looking at pre-employment goals. I wrote the curriculum on pre-employment opportunities. So people coming together and trying to just figure out, now, what would their goals be as they move forward? Do they want to go back to school? What is their career goal? So helping folks to look at what are their goals, and then from there, what kind of support services can they access? So, I mean, looking at how do people do their resume if they may have lived in a different gender prior to this time, and how can they navigate that issue if an employer is calling a reference? You know, how do you work with your reference to, how are they going to talk about you if you lived in another gender when you're being called? You know, so those kinds of pieces, looking at how to support folks in the interviewing process and looking at, you know, how to identify their goals and look at what networking opportunities would be helpful, you know, what other resources would be.
Talking about celebrities and transitioning, somehow the media never seems to cover what you say in your book, that there always are some health issues, or just about always, when you have surgery, similar to what you had. What don't people know about that?
Well, I think, you know, for me as a female-to-male individual, you know, there is a lot of, I mean, I've found that there continues to be this incredible mythology perpetuated about trans men and our genitalia, you know, that it's inadequate, when in actuality, the technological expertise is really phenomenal. And so I write about my experience with phalloplasty. Phalloplasty means the creation of a penis, a genital surgery, because there's such a lack of information about this, and that there continues to be this mythology perpetuated by the legal community, the public health community, and even the trans community itself, that our genitalia are inadequate, which I think is damaging psychologically and totally out of touch. So, you know, because we've seen the landscape change in California and in other states, I believe California is currently one of the 17 states and the District of Columbia that requires health insurance issued on a state level to cover transition-related surgery, or transition-related care, including surgery. And, you know, because we're seeing the landscape change, there are some post-surgical complications, most of which can be resolved. But people are now accessing care they never thought they would be able to access. And, you know, for a long time there was this idea that, oh, American trans men aren't interested in genital surgery, you know, whereas people in European countries are. Well, that's because they had access and we did not. And most people did not have $100,000 laying around. Most people were not able to access surgery. Now that we're actually getting our health care needs recognized and covered in some cases, and certainly it's been recognized for some time as medically necessary, not cosmetic or experimental, but this is really can be life-saving for folks, you know, that there are some complications that people are experiencing, and so the medical community is having to get up to speed to what those issues are.
What shocked me about your book is that you can actually have an operation, transitional medical procedure, and be fired the next day in some states legally. What's our next step politically to prevent something like this?
Well, we really need to have discrimination of protections across the board on a federal level. But, you know, the discrimination protections have been won state by state or jurisdiction by jurisdiction. So, you know, whether it's a city, a county, a state, and so forth, or, you know, on a federal level is what we really need to have gender identity protections across the board in all spheres of society. So, you know, there have certainly been cases where people have gotten the job and then announced that they were transgender, and then, you know, all of a sudden the job is not available anymore. And, you know, there was a case in 2012, the Macy decision, that where an individual, she sold her home, she moved to California to take the job, and then they said, oh, I'm sorry, that job's no longer available. Well, it was a clear case of discrimination. And so that case was won by the Transgender Law Center, which shows that under Title VII, transgender people are protected from discrimination. So, you know, we need to have, you know, more and more protections in place so that, and for people to know that this is illegal to discriminate against folks. You know, people, if they disclose in an interview process and they don't get the job, it's hard to prove discrimination. But if you have already received a job and then you disclose and then the job is no longer available, clearly that's discrimination.
You and I are listening to award-winning writer, speaker, and public health consultant Willie Wilkinson, author of the memoir Born on the Edge of Race and Gender, A Voice for Cultural Competency. Willie's book is the winner of the 2016 Lambda Literary Award in the Transgender Nonfiction category, and he's going to be doing a live reading on Saturday, October 15th at San Gabriel Valley Pride's 15th Pride Festival.
I will be on Saturday, October 15th at 1 o'clock. There's an author's event, and so I think I have about an hour. So I'll be reading some excerpts, which is, you know, basically my book, Born on the Edge of Race and Gender, A Voice for Cultural Competency, is really transforming the memoir genre into a cultural competency tool. So there's a lot of storytelling. I'm trying to use the power of storytelling to contextualize the movement for transgender equality. So I tell stories about my kids. I tell stories about, you know, navigating the men's locker room as a trans person to, you know, really put a face on the issue. We're not the monstrous predators, you know, that the opposition has portrayed us as, but we're just folks just trying to do, you know, daily things like other folks. And so, you know, I'll be on reading for something like half an hour, 40 minutes or something, and then there'll be Q&A so folks can come and ask plenty of questions.
And this is very family-oriented, so every year Pride says, everybody come on out and see this. It's a great event.
Oh, yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
As we wrap up here, and thank you for your time, if you could only have people get one thing from you, if you could only have your kids get one thing from you as a dad or as an artist and activist, what would you want that to be?
Oh, boy, these big questions you ask. I guess, you know, I love life, and I hope that everyone can have the opportunity to experience joy and not have to experience a lot of crap, a lot of discrimination. So I think, you know, that's what I'm working to create an environment where people can experience the good things in life peacefully without the hassles of discrimination.
Willie, thank you for your time today.
Oh, thank you so much for interviewing me.
You and I have been listening to award-winning transgender writer, speaker, and advocate Willie Wilkinson. Willie is the author of the memoir, Born on the Edge of Race and Gender, A Voice for Cultural Competency. And he's going to be doing a live reading from the Author's Lounge at San Gabriel Valley Pride's 15th Pride Festival this Saturday, October 15th at 1 o'clock in Pasadena's Central Park. Central Park is located at Del Mar and Raymond, and you're invited to come hear him. However, San Gabriel Valley Pride would like you to know that you're invited to come by before that. Their Pride Festival is a free, family-oriented event, which includes a play area for kids, pet adoptions, the Big Draw art event, live entertainment throughout the day, of course, the Author's Lounge, great food, and exhibits. You'll find more information on San Gabriel Valley Pride's website. That's sgvpride.org. Look for their festival, which is called 15 on the 15th. Once again, that is sgvpride.org. Meanwhile, check out Willie's website as well for more information on his book and speaking engagements. His website is williewilkinson.com. That's williewilkinson.com, and congratulations to him on his 2016 Lambda Literary Award. And that concludes this edition of Over Coffee. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to hear more Over Coffee podcasts, our link is twomaverix.com. That's twomaverix.com. And you can contact us at twomaverix@gmail.com. I'm Dot Cannon. Here's wishing you a cappuccino day.